And this is KPCW. It's 8:06 on this Thursday, April 11th, 38 degrees and sunshine here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giebois. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Thursday or happy Friday Eve to you. Yesterday, we were treated to some pretty nice weather in the Wasatch back, and we're going to help crank up the spring feeling even more. It should be just a beautiful day across the state with the Wasatch back being included in that. We'll see a daytime high climb into the mid and upper 50s in Park City by getting to 57 degrees, which is more than 5 degrees above where we should be for this time of year. So if you've been wanting some spring warmth, today is definitely a good day to get outside and enjoy. It should just be absolutely lovely under mostly sunny skies and generally light winds, but we could see those winds out of the northeast around 5 to 10 miles per hour during the course of the afternoon. Then tonight, it's mostly clear skies with the overnight lows falling into the mid and upper 30s. So it'll be chilly, but it definitely won't be too cold. And then with our winds increasing out of the south for Friday and Saturday, it's going to be even warmer than what we find today. It's actually going to be pretty mild. We'll see daytime highs in the low 60s for both Friday and Saturday, while Heber will likely be in the mid to potentially even upper 60s. As we get to 63 in Park City tomorrow, it won't be quite as warm on Saturday, but still pretty warm with the daytime high coming in at 62. And Friday night, we'll see an overnight low of 39. The only difference that we're really going to see between today and the next couple of days is with that southerly flow increasing. We will see some breezy conditions, and we'll also likely see a little bit more in the way of cloud coverage, but still not expecting anything too significant, with maybe a slight chance for a stray shower up in the mountains. Then as we go from the end of this weekend into next week, we do have a pattern change on the way. The high pressure that's keeping our weather quiet now will slowly be moving away to the east, and by Sunday, we'll start to see a system approaching from the west. I think through Sunday, we're still looking pretty good for the most part, but there will be at least a slight chance of seeing some showers, and the temperatures will begin to ease down. On Sunday, we'll see a daytime high in the low 50s in Park City, which means we could see times of rain and snow as the overnight low on Sunday night drops to 33 degrees. But again, at this point, the chance of wet weather on Sunday, not all that high. The chance of wet weather, though, will pick up on Monday as the system that approaches us on Sunday will likely move in by Monday, resulting in showers being more likely than not. Could see again a mix of rain and snow, but anticipating more snow than rain, with a daytime high that'll come in at 46 degrees and will drop below freezing on Monday night. And we also are likely going to see a trailing system move in between Tuesday and Wednesday to keep our chances for showers sticking around as our temperatures ease down even more. On Tuesday, we'll likely see a daytime high in the low 40s in Park City, dropping to the middle 20s on Tuesday night. And there's a chance on Wednesday, with a chance of snow showers, that we don't see a daytime high climb out of the 30s with a daytime high of 37. So we kind of have weather for every taste out there. Definitely going to have that spring feeling with sunshine the next few days. And then by the time we move into the middle of next week, it's going to be feeling more like winter than spring, Leslie.
Okay, thank you, Thomas. And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, it's Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning. So it's going to be another beautiful day in the mountains, like just said. Warm temperatures, sunny skies. Yesterday was generally quiet with not very many avalanches to report. A little bit of wet activity by the afternoon. Today we're going to have a generally low danger, but it'll be rising to moderate on the southerly aspects as temperatures heat up and the snow surface heats up as well. So just pay attention on the solars. If the snow surface begins to get wet, it's time to move on to some shaded aspects. Some good signs of that are just roller balls, pinwheels, or small point releases.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with the Executive Director of Hope Alliance, Diane Bernhard, talking about the growth of Hope Alliance, as well as how vision is good for not improving sight, but also for income and quality of life. Treasure Mountain Junior High School Principal Caleb Fine will be discussing the measures the school is taking to prevent student harassment and bullying, and the Executive Director of the Summit County Clubhouse, Jen O'Brien. We'll have an update on increasing membership and the plans for the Rotary Club grant that they just received. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Thomas Mullaney, talking about the incredibly complex task of developing a typing keyboard for the Chinese language with its thousands of characters and no alphabet. Then Dr. Keith Koper shares information about the University of Utah seismic stations and the important work they do monitoring earthquakes in our area. All of that coming up right after the Local News Hour at 9 a.m. Taking a look at some local news now, Olympic officials are in Utah touring venues and infrastructure for a potential 2034 Olympic Games. KPCW's Christine Weller followed them along on the first day and has this report.
The International Olympic Committee's Future Host Commission, along with IOC and Olympic and Paralympic leaders, met with Utah's Olympic Bid Committee at the University of Utah Wednesday. At the meeting, Utah presented its vision for the 2034 Olympic Games, and the main theme was Elevate. Utah's bid commission said the state wants to elevate local communities, elevate sport, and elevate the Games experience. The commission also wants to unify people at the community, state, and national level. Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson said the 2002 Olympics played a big part in unifying Utah communities. She said everyone has a personal story from the Games. For her, it was hosting a party to watch the opening ceremonies. One of her friends at the party was 9 months pregnant.
I remember that while we were watching, my friend's water broke and she went into labor. And so had her own little Olympics baby.
Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall said since Utah is one of the fastest growing states in the nation, many current residents didn't get to experience the 2002 Games. Yet 80% support the Olympic Games coming back. Further, Mendenhall said 100% of Utah's political leaders support the return of the Games.
It has nothing to do, and it actually supersedes politics. It's an example that I know our governor and lieutenant governor are proud of in the state of Utah, the secret sauce, we call it, when we come together to do hard things.
Mendenhall also said the game is perfectly aligned with Utah's goals. By 2030, Salt Lake City, along with Salt Lake County and Summit County, will have 100% net renewable energy, something the IOC is interested in. The state is also working on bringing in more passenger rails, which would also support the Olympics.
It's not that the games are going to make something happen that we weren't going to do anyway. It aligns perfectly with our future ambitions. And we know that the games can and will be a catalyst to better achieve our ambitions.
Utah also kept the Olympic spirit alive as it continues to draw global competitive events, which the IOC also likes to see. Utah has hosted over 1,100 summer and winter sporting events. There are also athletes from over 30 countries training in Utah. Zhang Hong, a Chinese Olympic champion speed skater with the IOC, said she even has former teammates coaching and training in Utah. Catherine Rainey Norman is a four-time Olympic speed skater and the chair of the bid committee. She said Utah also works to cultivate young athletes.
It's about inspiring our youth. Whether they go on to compete in the games, that is wonderful and we celebrate that. But it's also about the values that they learn through sport.
The bid commission also talked about how it has been working to improve the experience of the games. Future Olympic Commission Chair Carl Stoss said the 2002 games had the most attendees out of any winter sporting event. In 2002, Utah officials made changes to make the games a better experience. Tanya Carey, a former Paralympian, said the 2002 games was the first to have the same organizing committee for the Olympics and Paralympics.
And I felt the difference here. It was quality, it was welcoming, it was absolutely excellent delivery of the Paralympic Games.
The Utah Bid Commission has been working for years to make a future Games an even better experience. Randy Norman said the committee spoke with Olympic athletes to understand what things they would like to see, with many saying they wanted more resources for their families. That's why Utah is launching an athlete family initiative to help families find affordable housing, tickets, and transportation. Fraser Bullock, president of the bid committee, said all Utah venues are within an hour of the Olympic Village.
I remember back in 02, I could go to an event in the mountains in the morning, I could go to speed skating in the afternoon, I could go to figure skating downtown or short track, all in one day, 3 to 4 events in one day. It was spectacular.
The Future Host Commission liked all these highlights, especially that Utah is cultivating young athletes and already has venues ready for the Olympics. Christoph Duby, the Olympic Games Executive Director, said young people are the future Olympic leaders.
At some point, we'll be replaced by a new generation of management. This is the same for the foundation, this is the same for the commission. So this is the opportunity to work long term.
Stoss wouldn't say for sure if Utah will be awarded the 2034 Games, but said he has a good feeling about it. Salt Lake City is the preferred host for the 2034 Games and is the only official host being considered. The IOC will select a host for the 2034 Games on July 24th. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, a simple pair of glasses can make a huge difference in people's income, especially in some poverty-stricken areas. That was the report earlier this week, heard on NPR in the studio to discuss that. With us a bit more, I have the Executive Director of Hope Alliance, Diane Bernhardt. Good morning.
Good morning.
So maybe just start and tell us, what is the mission and goal of Hope Alliance?
Hope Alliance is... The mission of Hope Alliance is to provide vision care and eyeglasses and potentially referrals for those who don't have access. So that could be for a number of reasons. It could be because you live in Uganda in a primitive area that there just are no glasses. It could be because your you don't have insurance and your family can't afford it here in Utah.
Right. So I guess for people who have never had to wear glasses, they really wouldn't understand just the impact that putting on a pair of glasses for the first time has. I mean, all of a sudden you can see leaves on the tree, or you can read the book, or see the chalkboard. Here in the U.S., it doesn't seem to be as big of a deal, though, to get a pair of glasses, or is it?
Well, it just depends. It's much easier because we can just pop by Walmart and grab a pair of readers, which changes the game for anybody over 50. But even in rural parts of Utah and other parts of the United States, it's very difficult for people. They don't even have the capacity to pop $15 for something, because if you have to select between rent and food, you know what you're picking, especially for your family.
Yeah. So the NPR report showed that it is a huge deal across the world. And Hope Alliance, of course, knows a little bit more about this because you kind of take your program on the road.
Yeah, we sure do. Yeah, so we were very excited to read this article because this is something that we've known, well, we all can know sort of anecdotally. Hope Alliance has known firsthand the ramifications it can make by having a pair of glasses, not just from an income perspective, but also from an educational perspective, from a interpersonal perspective. If you can't see someone's expression on their face at a distance, communication drops.
Yeah. So I guess what struck you as part of this reporting? That we've seen not just NPR, but there's been several.
Yeah, also the New York Times and The Week. Well, what was remarkable to all of us, we got very excited because it's something that we know. We, like I mentioned, everybody can intuitively figure it out. We've witnessed it, but now there's been a study done that actually quantifies it. So there was a study done in Bangladesh with approximately 800 inhabitants of about 50 villages. And the short of it is that they gave half the people a pair of readers that suited them and half they didn't. And for the 8-month period of the trial, it showed a 33% increase in income for an individual, which is a poverty lifter. That can lift people out of poverty.
So why is that? I mean, what did the glasses do?
One example is that there was an example that they had that someone was harvesting and cutting vegetables and selling them. She could cut her vegetables at a much greater speed and then be able to sell more of them. I mean, just very simple. It's very simple.
Yeah. And then also being able to find bugs and pull them off.
That's the report
I heard. Yeah. You know, I spent 2 weeks in Uganda with Hope Alliance, and for those we helped, it really seemed mostly about the ability for them to read the Bible once again. I mean, what's the issue there? I mean, that it also affects their livelihood? I mean, have you seen that directly?
We've seen it directly. Well, in Uganda, I can't really comment because I haven't been there and we haven't studied how it's impacting them financially. But that is the number one thing. Although you're right, the Bible was an aspect of it. I can give you an example from a patient in Moab. We have a clinic in Moab, and this patient was about 50 years old. He had immigrated from Mexico. He'd never worn a pair of glasses in his life, and he was profoundly visually impaired. You could easily say blind. He came in without a job. Really, his posture reflected the fact that he needed to be filled protected from the world. We saw him every year, sometimes twice a year when we serve in Moab. And he started out as someone who wouldn't even make an eye contact with us. And the last time we were there, he had come in to get his glasses repaired. And instead of repairing, we decided to give him a new pair. We put him on, and I said, oh, my gosh, Jose, you look really excellent in those. And he goes, yeah, sexy. And he doesn't even speak Spanish. I mean, he doesn't even speak English. He just goes, sexy, and is looking over his shoulder. He was completely transformed, and now he's working in a local hotel. It's transformed his life financially and from a confidence point of view.
Yeah. For as many pairs of glasses, I think, that were handed out in Uganda, there were just as many that we had to turn away because of cataracts. I mean, glasses don't fix cataracts. So what is Hope Alliance doing to try and remedy that? Or are you just sticking with glasses?
No, actually, so the two low-hanging fruit that exists in vision care and restoring sight is refraction, you know, just getting a pair of glasses, and cataracts. One of our goals is to try to partner with other organizations in which Hope Alliance would do the screening and the provision of glasses and identify those who have cataracts and immediately refer them to a cataract camp where they can have surgery while they're in air quote town, because sometimes they travel 24 hours by foot to come and see us, and it would be ideal if they can have the cataract care immediately. So we're very close to finalizing a partnership with an organization called iCor. They are located in Boston, but they have a presence here. The staff members have a presence here. They serve in three locations in Tanzania. So we're setting ourselves up to go to Tanzania, meet them there in the beginning of November, where we would set up that model of doing the refractions, identifying them, and then they would do cataract care for the camp that's there, but also they have a doctor there that will do the continuation. As much as possible, that's the sort of thing that we'd like to do, because we're there anyway and we identify it. Mm-hmm. It's an efficiency that to be gained.
Yeah, and I know that not only reading glasses that you kind of distribute, but sunglasses, especially in those equatorial areas, yeah?
Yeah, helps to prevent certain conditions like tritium, but we don't have to get super deep in eye disease, but tritium's really a big thing.
So where does Hope Alliance go? You mentioned Moab. We've mentioned Uganda.
Also Mexico, Guatemala, and soon to be Tanzania.
Okay. And then you rely on volunteers.
Oh, yes, we do.
To join you. So
yeah,
tell me about that.
It's a really... What is really great about volunteering with Hope Alliance is the fact that you really get to be a person who's provisioning the service to a person. It's always important to donate. It's important to support in many ways. But when you really get to sit across from a patient and talk to them about their circumstances and watch the transformation, I will say that there is nothing like watching someone see for the first time. It's you can't really speak about it. It's so powerful. You would know.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And in terms of just Hope Alliance, in terms of your growth, you're really seeing more of an expansion as opposed to... Talk to me a little bit about the last, 5 years.
Yes, 5 years. I joined Hope Alliance in October of 2019, and I knew something about vision care, but only anecdotally, because I have a son who's legally blind. But I felt as though, wow, this is something that I understand. I understand the ramifications of it, and it's just something so easy. We were mostly serving internationally and not in a robust way that was working towards sustainability or working toward expanding the service like cataract care. And also, we weren't serving very much locally, and it was difficult to look out my office window and think, wow, right there, across the street, there's people who need glasses. Sure, we should continue in Uganda, we should continue in Guatemala, but we shouldn't leave our home unserved.
Yeah. So you've been able then to do more because what? More grants, more funding, more...
A lot of grant writing, a lot more community support. I think the community, when it became apparent that we were focusing our efforts here too, our community also started supporting Hope Alliance to support our friends and neighbors.
Okay. And again, this was founded way back when by John Hanrahan.
Yeah, 1999. So this is our 25th anniversary.
Yeah. So specifically, though, I mean, the missions remain the same, providing vision care to people who
need it. That's always been part of the mission. But at the beginning, the mission was broader. It was medical, dental, vision, and basic needs like sewage and clean water. At some point, I don't know exactly when, because it was before my time, they began focusing in, pun intended, on vision care.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, part of this interview will link some of those studies that have been done.
Great.
Anything else you wanted to add?
No, I just really appreciate the time. Thanks very much. It's very exciting to see this sort of work that you do in the news.
Thanks. Well, as we reported, a Treasure Mountain Junior High School student is speaking out against another anti-Semitic incident in her classroom. The student, who asked to remain anonymous, said she overheard another student say something along the lines of "all Jews should die." Treasure Mountain staff also reportedly found multiple swastika drawings from students there. KPCW at the time reached out to Treasure Mountain principal Caleb Fine for a response. At the time, he said he disputed the characterization of the events that the student provided to KPCW, but couldn't provide further information. He did offer to provide some general information, but only if the station would guarantee to air the interview in its entirety, what the station at the time would not agree to. So we've asked him to come on to the local news hour so that we can interview, air that entire interview. So good morning, Caleb, and thanks for being here.
Awesome, Leslie. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so the student reported that another student was drawing swastikas and said he wants all Jews dead or something to that effect. She reported this to school officials. Your assistant met with the girl's father, who told us four more students were pulled from class and interviewed. So tell us what it is that you disputed with the reporting there.
Well, I can't go into specific details. And what I told Christine was not everything's entirely accurate, because, again, what happens when a lot of people talk is some things are misheard or misunderstood. No one's trying to misrepresent anything. And the heart of what I want to share is, you know, ultimately, yeah, we can't go into specific details. And it's a FERPA law. It's challenging. I don't like it. I wish we could tell everyone everything. But I also really respect the law. And the heart of the law is to protect kids. So can I go into the details that most people probably want? No, I can't. But ultimately, the good news is that student is a great young lady. And we're working hard to try to eliminate every single moment of racial statements, anti-Semitic statements, discriminatory statements. They don't belong in schools, and we're going to continue to work hard because the only acceptable number is zero.
Yeah. What actions, though, is the school taking, though, in response to this?
Yeah, I appreciate that. In general, right, we know there was an OCR complaint. We know we have issues that we have to work on. We have a responsibility and a charge to do more and do better. So at Treasure specifically, what we noticed was there's an opportunity to be more consistent. So what we're doing is a weekly lesson in terms of, and really focusing on, what are these things, making sure we're explicit with kids. We're talking about the role the students can take in eliminating this, and we're giving explicit examples. And then we're going to move into resiliency. We're talking about some of the history behind these things, because we believe we have a role to play. We believe we have a responsibility to try to lean into the complaint and do more. And we want kids to be safe. And
so where are these weekly lessons happening?
Great. At Treasure, we have advisory classes. So all of our students, Monday through Thursday, have an advisory class. That class serves a variety of roles, including academic intervention. But once a week, each teacher with a group of approximately 20 to 25 students is delivering that lesson.
All right. And that impacts all students.
Yeah, so
every student has an advisory.
750 students have an advisory. Of course, absences come into play. We're not letting perfection keep good from happening. So, you know, there's going to be weeks where kids miss, but every week, every student, that's the goal.
So are there policy guidelines to define a punishment when a student is found to kind of violate the rules?
That's a great question. So we have safe school policies in the Park City School District, and that defines, that outlines what principals do and how they respond. And there's a variance. It's fair to say that if you're engaging in anti-Semitic talk, if you're engaging in racist talk, you should expect to be suspended. We can't go into details on like each individual circumstance, but you should expect that. And then we use progressive discipline in the safe school policy. So if a student does engage in it multiple times, it's going to escalate in terms of consequence. But there's more than just that. One of the critical elements that we're trying to focus on even more than in the past, because we believe it was a shortcoming for Treasure, is an opportunity to really lean into the child once they come back from the suspension, be it a day or be it 100 days, right? To really have them meet with a staff member on multiple occasions and process through, like, how can we help this student do better? Our goal in consequence is not solely like, it is accountability, but the truth is we're in education because we want kids to learn and grow. So if we can connect with them when they return and they can understand the hurt that they've done, that's the win. That's where we can hopefully help change our internal community and the greater community, because no one, regardless of beliefs, I've never had a parent tell me I'm okay with harassment in the school. That's a pretty spot where we can all agree on. So that's what we're working towards.
So the district has a so-called zero tolerance policy towards harassment. I mean, what does that mean? What does it require of the schools and the school district?
I'm glad you asked, because I think that creates a level of confusion, because zero tolerance, a lot of times we go to what we know in society, like you're gone forever. Zero tolerance, that's not the way it's interpreted. Zero tolerance means it must be addressed. So when it comes to our attention, we have to investigate and we have to issue appropriate consequences based on that. We cannot say, oh, it doesn't matter. And I know it does matter. It matters greatly. Our vision is for students to be safe. There's an engaged challenge. We want them to reach their full potential, but that safety is what really comes into play. And if you don't feel safe in the school, you're not going to learn. So that's why we have to address it. And then again, we go through progressive process if it occurs with the same student multiple times.
So a parent had mentioned that district employees, including teachers, may fear retribution if they speak up or discipline students. So how can the district change that so that people aren't afraid to speak up?
I think each secondary school specifically is really focusing on, we need you to report. We want you to report, and we want to protect you in that process. I don't have a perfect answer to this. At Treasure, we've got the Enough campaign. We've got QR codes. We want kids to report issues so we can address it, so we can address accountability, but also education. And then I think the follow-up to that is we're making it explicitly clear that retaliation of any sort, that's another safe school violation. We go right back to the policy. We go right back to a progressive consequence in the process. There's no place for retaliation. So if someone feels retaliated against, we need them to tell us that too. And let's see if we can lean into it, and let's see if we can address it.
Well, when you mentioned, students with repeated incidents, I mean, if what we're doing isn't making a difference, do we need to look at other consequences?
I think that we need to look at more consistency in education, and that's what we're focused on. Most of our students are not repeat offenders. Have there been? Absolutely, right? That's a reality to being in education. We're going to have kids that make mistakes in a variety of worlds more than once, and the first consequence won't work. Fortunately, in most situations, in all facets of discipline, the first consequence is effective, especially when we follow up and provide after support.
So, to protect all students, let's not focus on this case, but I mean, let's speak in generalities here. If a student was heard to say, I'm going to kill fill in the blank, what happens to that kid once it's reported?
We have to investigate. And if someone said something, we still have to dig in and look into how can we verify that that happened. So that's an investigation process. It could result in interviews. It could result in us looking at camera footage. It could result in us, hopefully, if a teacher or adult in the building heard it, that's very helpful, because then we're not having student said versus student said. So we're going to investigate that, and then we're going to go right into the policy at that point. So it's documented investigation. We're going to log that. We're going to go into the policy, and depending on what was determined depends on the consequence. But again, if a student engages in that, says something like that, they should expect to be suspended. If they have a past history, what that's going to look like could be different. We've had students that for a variety of things, from, unfortunately, we have vapes that show up in schools. And if those happen multiple times, there's circumstances where they could go to a hearing at the district office. The same thing would be true if a student was engaging in multi-antisemitic incidents. And that has happened. That's the goal, is for that not to happen. The goal is for it to stop, because if a kid feels violated, they're not learning. That's not a safe environment. And no one believes this should be happening. It needs to stop.
Yeah. Any idea how many harassment incidents you're seeing at the school each month?
Each month. Good question. So there's kind of two instances. I think I looked this up because I expected this to be asked. We have had 12 incidents this year where students have at least used racist, anti-Semitic language, or it goes to the four categories in the OCR. So we're also talking about sexual harassment, harassment based on disability, categorized all those. We've had 12 incidents where students this year have used language. That doesn't mean it was directed at or determined to be a harassment case, but I want to be as transparent as possible. That's our reality. That's what's come to us. We've been able to investigate and verify and say this happens, issue appropriate consequences for it. It's down a little bit, and we believe that we might actually see an uptick with our emphasis to report. Please bring it to us, because if we're not involved, I don't think we can be a part of the solution. So we might see an uptick. And if we see an uptick, we're going to address that aggressively. Haven't yet in the first 3 weeks of this really intentional approach to try to get kids to report, even more so than we have in the past.
So this training, how long is that? I mean, it's going to go through the end of the school year?
Yeah, we're doing it every week for the remainder of the year. We're talking to kids about the issues, and we're really trying to help them learn and understand the hurt, the why, and take a breath before they say something with this underdeveloped prefrontal cortex where, 13, 14, 15-year-olds make mistakes and say something. some really, really poor things. And we need them to reflect on that a little bit more. It's got to stop.
So is it a one and done, or do you continue it next year as
I believe there's a role that we have to play into next year. I haven't had a chance to define exactly what it will look like next year, but we're having a lot of success with what we're doing now. So, again, I think consistency is the opportunity at Treasure that we're leaning in on.
All right, so an opportunity and also for the child then to ask questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. So what are the guidelines? We've talked a little bit about some of what happens to the kid that is, you know, pointed out to be issuing these anti-Semitic statements or whatever. What about the guidelines to support students who are impacted by what was said or done?
Absolutely. So we want to support that student, because that student, we want to get them back to a safe place as soon as possible. We have world-class counselors in the Park City School District. It's something that our school board, our superintendent have invested in greatly, so we're appreciative of that. So that's going to be a first offering, right? How can we get you to a counselor, process where you're at? But then there's a lot of other things that we can do for the student. We can look at if they're feeling unsafe in the hallways, we can let them transfer it at different times, right? We can look at class changes. We can look at leaves of absences, all the things that they need. We're really just trying to bring them back to a safe environment. But fortunately, we've got great counselors, and that's going to be our first offering. They also have a open door policy with me or any admin, where they know they have a direct line to me or another admin. If they're seeing future issues, if they're feeling unsafe, we want them to know that they have a direct line to an adult, someone that can hopefully step in and help.
So let's talk just a minute about the psychology of 8th and 9th graders. They can be difficult. We know their hormones are going off. They're testing boundaries set by parents, from school officials. Any parent knows it's not an easy time. But from your educated perspective, what's the mindset of kids that are causing the problems by being mean or being a bully? I mean, is it about drawing attention to him or herself? Is it a power thing? Is it about showing off to their friends? Is it a reflection of problems at home?
Well, first of all, a great parent can't blame themselves, because no one is immune from their child having behavioral issues. So we have to have grace in that process, grace towards ourselves, that no one's immune, no school's immune, no parent is immune. But what is the issue? There could be layers. I think at the end of the day, when we're dealing with, really kind of starts in middle school, and we're hitting the peak of it at Treasure Mountain Junior High in 8th and 9th grade, but this is where kids are the main influence of their parents and the adults over their life. They're pushing that away. And they're starting to say, my main influence is my friends, it's society, but it's also on steroids, not literally, but figuratively, because they're on the roller coaster. We see this, parents know this. The highs are so high, the lows are so lows, or they just are like, meh, nothing, I don't want to talk about it. But rarely are they able to sustain a normal growth path, because their emotions are going everywhere. So we know we have underdeveloped prefrontal cortexes. We know we have incredible influence from the outside pressuring them to, they're trying to balance this society and this world, and home life may be challenging. That's certainly a factor when it is, but we've had kids from the ideal home life make mistakes, and we have kids from hard home lives make mistakes. They're kids. We got to teach, we got to educate, and we got to help them be the best version of themselves moving forward.
Yeah, and I guess what's the response from kids? I mean, are they genuinely surprised that they were being, you know, kind of the turd they were?
It varies. You know, usually when a kid is in my office and they're in trouble, they're pretty remorseful, at least. And, you know, very few people want to get caught. And we try to get to, are you upset because you're caught? Or are you able to get to the reflection point? And this usually takes a little bit of time, where you're upset because you realize this wasn't the best version of myself. Hurting my fellow peer was not the best version of myself. That language does not help our society and our school progress in a positive manner. So it takes time for them to get there. But yeah, a lot of times kids are like, I know I shouldn't have done that. I made an impulsive, terrible choice.
Yeah. So the district has previously mentioned that they do want parent support and collaboration. So how can parents help?
Thank you for asking that, Leslie. I think if I were to say, there'd be three things. One is, talk about it with your kids as well. If we can all be talking about this issue and doing it consistently, it's not a one-off conversation. It's a consistent conversation. For my Treasure parents, we're talking about the themes of the topics and advisory, and we want that conversation to go home. I think the second thing I'd recommend is, be vigilant, parents, in knowing what your kids are exposed to. They have powerful tools around them, and we don't teach anti-Semitism. We don't teach hate. Could they be exposed to it in the school? Absolutely. We're a community. It happens. But they're also, some of the greatest exposures happen outside of the school and then come in. So be vigilant. And then the last thing I would say is kindness and forgiveness. Forgiveness is a powerful thing. There is accountability to this behavior. But Dr. Jill shared a very powerful quote by Martin Luther King Jr. at the meeting, and hate cannot drive out hate. Only love does that. And I think that if we're a society that also forgives and realizes we've got 13, 14, 15, let's lean in with love and let's take care of these kids, that's the school I want to be a part of. I want to be a part of a school that has accountability, but also loves each student. These kids are the most valuable kids in the world. They're kids that belong to another parent, and that parent says, this kid matters. So we've got to love them that way. That's our charge.
Yeah. And again, I mean, it comes down to, I mean, there's this mentality of kind of it's us and them, where when you really think about it, it's just us, right?
It is us.
And I don't know how you teach that lesson. I mean, it's taken, right, me decades to kind of figure that out. But there's really a critical importance when you start seeing people as yourself. I don't know how you teach that.
Empathy. We'll keep working on it. We'll all try to do it together.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just really grateful for the opportunity to talk.
Okay. Thank you. That's Treasure Mountain High School, or Junior High School Principal Caleb Fine. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Clubhouse is Executive Director Jen O'Brien. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
So Clubhouse was one of 9 organizations recently selected to receive this year's Park City Rotary Grant. Tell us, what did you receive and what are you going to do with the money?
We were so grateful to be. I know it was a competitive process this year with, I think, more than 40 applicants. So we were thrilled. We received $5,000 from Rotary, and it's in support of, kind of an important initiative for us. It's supporting our education and employment dinner and programming on Thursday nights, which for us, the Summit County Clubhouse serves adults 18 and up with mental health challenges such as depression, anxiety, PTSD, substance abuse disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar, those type of diagnoses. And for our organization, most clubhouses internationally are really modeled around a business day, 9 to 5 hours of programming. And the idea is getting members back after a period of instability, back into the routine of productive work, engaging in community, building skills, building confidence, and then hopefully relaunching back out into their own workforce. Well, for our clubhouse here in Summit County, it's extremely difficult to live off of disability benefits. So we have, more urgency and a much higher percentage of our membership that are returning to the workforce or that are living, that are working full or part-time and going to school while navigating mental health challenges. So for us, that 9-to-5 model just doesn't work. We need to expand our footprint and be able to provide programming and continual support for those who are returning to the workforce or to their college courses and so on. And so this is a really big endorsement of that strategy for us, and it's going to let us do, a lot of great work on those evening and even some weekend programming.
Yeah. So what does that Thursday dinner, what happens at an education and employment dinner?
Well, it's variable. Sometimes there is formal programming. We have dove into topics where we're not necessarily lecturing, but talking together as a community about time management, about organizational skills, about the job search process, about going to school while navigating mental health challenges. But truly, it's more of an informal check-in. It's more of, I think a lot of times when you are working with mental illness, you're not necessarily open with your peers and colleagues at work about your experiences. And so to have a safe space where you can go and share those experiences with others who understand what you're going through in an informal setting, there's great value there. So we're cooking, preparing meals together, sitting down at the table together. And sometimes it's freestyle and sometimes it's a more intentionally facilitated conversation. But either way, often it ends up with a game of apples to apples at the end of the night. So it does vary in style.
So the money's paying for basically the staff time to be there over overtime, as well as the food that you're preparing.
And we do have, that is kind of an informal setting. For our members, we also have more formal education and employment programming where we are providing either one-on-one direct case management time appointments or time during the regular work order day where we're working on interview skills, we're helping with the resumes, we're helping with the job search. We have, we may talk about later, our transitional and supported employment programs. Certainly, I've driven, we've taken people to college campuses, connected them with the disability resource centers. So there's a lot of one-on-one support, but those dinners are not really the time for that. They're more time for connection and community.
So let's talk a little bit about that. You are looking for local employers to partner with Clubhouse for your transitional employment program. What is that?
This is one of the hallmarks of a Clubhouse. And just to back up, we are an independently run organization, but we're modeled after Clubhouse International. There are 340 Clubhouses around the world. And to be honest, we are so lucky to have one in our county because the impact is outstanding. When you realize there's not really a Clubhouse, and one of our members says there's, eventually there should be a YMCA, a library, and a Clubhouse in every town. But right now we are lucky to have one in Summit County. And one of the hallmarks of a Clubhouse is the transitional employment program. And I think it's a recognition, and this may be familiar to many people, that often for someone with mental health challenges or diagnosed mental illness, employment pathways and career pathways are interrupted. Even education pathways are interrupted. It's so common. And there's kind of a string of dead-end jobs or gaps in your resume, and it's really hard to recover from that. So transitional employment is a recognition that for many of our members, we can give a little bit of support, and they are back on their feet and working and running with and doing fantastic. And there are others who aren't ready for independent full-time employment. And for an employer, it would be a very high risk. When you get a resume of someone who has gaps such as you might see, it's a high risk to take a gamble on an employee like that. So transitional employment reduces that risk for our local employment partners. It's an agreement with the Clubhouse that we will train for an entry-level position. Our staff will take over placing one of our members in that position and supporting that person in that position for a period of 6 to 9 months at which time they can transition out, maybe even get hired full time, and give that space to another person, give that opportunity to another person. So these are always entry level jobs. They can be clerical, they can be janitorial, they can be service sector jobs, but they are part time. And the impact, we went to a Clubhouse International conference this fall and heard this woman from Salt Lake, from our partner organization in Salt Lake, speak, who was in her younger years had some extreme social anxiety and took her first transitional employment position at a law firm, emptying the shredders and really basically doing clerical support work. And over a period of time, went back to SLIC, took her first few courses, went to the U, ended up becoming a paralegal, and now runs the paralegal department for that same law firm. And talked very openly about the fact that she still has that same social anxiety, but it taught her to be able to show up every day, no matter what the job was, no matter whether it was emptying the shredder or running the department. She still shows up and functions through that anxiety that she still lives with. Hmm. And it was a powerful example of how TEs can work.
Yeah, so you say you're reducing the risk by what? Just making sure that the staff member that you're hoping to place here is well-trained, and that kind of takes the burden and time and money off of the employer?
Yes, and. Okay, so we will do the training, and we will do the hiring. They don't need to go through the application process. And then if this employee is not able to show up, we have a designated point person at the Clubhouse that will fill in and cover that shift, unpaid, because we are paid as our Clubhouse salary. So that employer knows that shift is going to be covered. And, there have been times where a staff person will show up with the member employee just to kind of coach them through that first hour if they're feeling anxious. So there are a lot of different ways that we can just make sure that shift is covered.
Yeah. So are you doing that with volunteers? or
that's no, all we're doing that. So it's a big commitment for a small organization like ours. But that is why it's a part time. It might be two mornings a week. It's during our regular clubhouse hours, and it's we're also not placing a member. Different from other organizations, these members aren't coming once a week for a counseling session. They are members. We've known them for years. We know their situations. So I think the risk is lower for us than it would be for someone if we were working with someone that, you know, was kind of just a client rather than a member. And yes, it's a big commitment. We have enough staffing right now to be able to support one transitional employment position, and we're looking for a partner.
Great. So they can just contact you if they're interested in mm-hmm. talking about more about
mm-hmm.
it. All right. So the word is out. You're seeing your membership really grow.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's been very exciting and also a bit challenging. We've had 50% now membership growth since September, and higher than that when you count on our, you know, daily attendance is up dramatically. So that's been super exciting. I think it's just it's just the sign of the times that there's a great need out there, and also a sign of our efforts to really expand our footprint to those evening opportunities, to weekend opportunities, social and recreational programming. We've really committed to making sure that it works not only for those who can show up for the work order day that we're kind of well known and famous for, but also have other more social needs. I think the lens through which everything we do is done through the lens of creating opportunities to avoid isolation, because in our mind, you know, it's really important to have medication and therapy. To go to your therapy session every Wednesday is great, but if you're spending the rest of the week in your parents' basement, as one of my members put it, something's not working. So we're really trying to create opportunities to avoid that social isolation, and I think people are responding well to that.
All right. You are in the midst of your Raise the Roof fundraiser. What's going on?
Yeah, exciting times, Leslie, because with the membership growth, and that's a significant growth in operating costs to accommodate that. At the same time, we had some lovely surprises in 2024. We have some damage to our roof that needs to be urgently replaced before summer. And we now have some siding repair that needs to be done. So capital expense campaign, we're looking to raise $28,000 to cover the replacement of the roof. We've had a generous match from Dan and Nancy Freifeld, and from Janet and Michael Feely, and from one of our member families, Angela Vitale and her family. So we're well on our way, and if there's anyone in the community that's interested in helping out, please reach out. We would love the support.
Okay, so, but the roof isn't your only problem, it sounds like.
It's not, but you know, we've got quite a few capital expense challenges this year, but I think our board is, you know, on top of it. They've done a good job at budgeting for, you know, we have to keep up not only the organization but the house. It's owned by the Community Foundation for explicit use by the clubhouse, but all of the upkeep obligations are on our clubhouse organization, and they've prepared fairly well for that.
Yeah, so I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, just the furnace going out, the clogged sinks, or, you know?
Yeah, so this year, I think our biggest priorities are the roof and the siding, and some landscaping improvements on the outside would make the neighborhood happy. And then maintenance as needed. You know, we might have had a sprinkler problem last summer, and we did have a plumbing problem earlier this year with sewage. Just a sewage tank needed to be pumped out. So there are quite a few expenses, just as there would be for maintaining any house.
All right. And then asking people to save the date for May 18th. What's happening then?
Yes. Well, slight change. May 18th is still going to be our volunteer spring work day, which is traditionally, I think they have, you know, 20 or 30 volunteers from the community will come in and do indoor and outdoor projects, spring cleanup projects. And this year we're looking to also, you know, stain the deck and repair some, do some, you know, landscaping changes, and some repairs, some minor repairs to some things in the garage and in the building. We were going to try and do our celebration barbecue on that same day, but my facilities committee just yesterday said I don't think they'd be done with the projects quite in time to clean up for that event. So we'll have a date soon for probably early June for a community-wide open house backyard barbecue just for people. I think even if you aren't inclined to be a member of the clubhouse, I don't think there's anyone here in this community that doesn't know someone that is living with mental health challenges. And so to know that this resource is here, to know that this resource exists and how it works, and to be able to walk through that clubhouse and see how it's designed and what members do when they spend the day there is really valuable. So that barbecue is kind of a hook and a way to get people to come visit and know that we're here.
Okay. You've got lots of information online?
Mm-hmm. Yep. On our website.
SummitCountyClubhouse.org.
And if you want to sign up to be part of that volunteer workday, just click on volunteer opportunities.
Okay. Anything else, Jen, you want to mention?
No, just appreciative to KPCW for the platform as always.
You're welcome. Jen O'Brien is the executive director of the Summit County Clubhouse. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. And just in the headlines here, relatives have confirmed this morning that O.J. Simpson has died after a battle with prostate cancer. He passed away yesterday. In February, the family had shared that he had been diagnosed with cancer. You've been listening to Local News Hour here on KPCW.